success and every encounter with the king of Babylon. And these things are written for our learning, upon whom the ends of the world are come, because we, like Daniel, must learn to make God to be our plan maker, so that the work in the last days will be finished contrary to any human planning, as Testimonies to Ministers 300 so plainly says. Now, last session we came to the point where Daniel has stood before King Nebuchadnezzar, the infuriated, enraged king, and has so easily and successfully obtained time to go away and seek the answer from the great source, namely the God of heaven. So now we read in verse 17 and 18 of Daniel 2. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning the secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, why was it so important that Daniel not perish? Was Daniel concerned for himself? Not for a moment. Daniel was selfless. And if his death was necessary to promote the cause of God, well and good. But Daniel was very much aware that the preservation of his life and that of his three companions was vital to the cause of God at this point of time. Daniel did not die a violent death, even though he was subjected to a death decree later in the lion's den episode. Neither did his three companions die violently, even though they too were subjected to a death decree at the burning fiery furnace. Remember, we're studying types of these last days. And again, God will have his Daniel and his companions, and I trust that everyone in this room and many others too will be numbered amongst that company in the very near future. In the last great controversy, once the basin is closed, it will be strictly important that not one of God's true people die, and they won't. No one who is finally sealed and enters Jacob's trouble as a member of the 144,000 will actually experience death. But they will most certainly be subjected to a death decree, and they'll come as close to death as those men did in the fiery furnace or in the lion's den, but they will not die. And because Daniel and his companions were types of this last company, they could not die either, otherwise it would be a very spoiled or marred type, an imperfect type. Now, Daniel understood correct procedure. He understood God's way. So they went before God, and I'll just emphasize this point again, not even attempting to work out a solution to their problem. They brought the problem to God, they told God what the problem was, they gave it to God, and they left it there for him to solve in his own good time and way. The incorrect procedure, of course, is to go to God with a solution. That's the Babylonian way. Then ask God to effect your solution by adding his power to your plan. Daniel didn't do that, and because he didn't, he got the answer. Verse 19, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Pardon me. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God for ever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who has given me wisdom and might, and has made known to me now what we desired of thee, for thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. Now then, as we read those verses, what is the one word that would sum up Daniel's evaluation of God? He was saying, God is what? My source. God is my source. And in so doing, what did Daniel acknowledge himself to be? Receiver. Right. And in that, by keeping that relationship between himself and God ever clear, and by working in harmony with that relationship, Daniel understood the secret of power, and he entered into God's rest. Now, when by those procedures he obtained from God the answer, then what must Daniel obviously have experienced? Perfect rest, perfect peace, perfect satisfaction, perfect confidence, and perfect security. He had nothing to worry about. He absolutely knew that God was working for him, He knew that with God there could be no such thing as failure, loss, impossibility or defeat, and so he had perfect rest. Now that perfect rest was not something which God arbitrarily gave to him and at the same time deprived the Babylonians of. That rest was the natural outworking of that course of action. Right? Natural outworking. It was the fruit of that situation, not something which God engineered particularly. It was the outworking, in other words, of principles and laws. Now, when Daniel saw what he had to tell the king, then Daniel recognized at once, that he had to tell the king what the king didn't want to hear. Now you understand this a little better when we look at Daniel 2 in a moment. We're not about to be given a study on Daniel 2 like of which you've heard before. We were looking at this from an altogether fresh and I believe a more correct angle, because God is not concerned with the mere rise and fall of political powers. And Daniel 2 is not the revelation of that, although of course you can read it into it. It is instead the revelation of the sure outworking of man's way versus God's way. That is what Daniel 2 is all about. And Daniel recognized, as the dream and the interpretation of it was opened before his mind, that he had to go in before that king and tell that king what that king didn't want to know. And already the king wasn't very happy. He was already a roaring lion. So therefore, the visible prospect for Daniel was that he was going to lose his head over this whole matter. And Daniel therefore could very, very logically have said, well, now I surely have got a problem. And he did have a problem. The problem was how to bring this undesirable message from the king's point of view, of course, before that king and survive the telling of it. Now Daniel could once again have turned to his own human logic and said, well, this wild king, what good is the interpretation going to do him anyway? Because the real people that benefit from this interpretation is God's people. So I'll just tell the king what the dream is, sure enough, in case he remembers it anyway and can check my revelation. But then I'll be careful to water down the revelation so that the king will not really know what the dream's all about, and I'll tell him flattering things will make him happy and thus preserve my life. Now, doesn't that sound a very good piece of human reasoning from the human point of view? Quite certainly. But if Daniel had done that, he would have reverted to a human solution to the problem, and that would have been fatal. Instead of saving him, it would have destroyed him. Nothing more certain than that. And I appreciate the fact with all my heart that Daniel took the stand, right, now God has told me what the dream is. God has told me the interpretation of this dream. He has done so that I can tell the king. Therefore, God's plan is for me to go before that king and truthfully tell him the dream and truthfully tell the interpretation thereof. Now, if that's God's plan, I'll do what God says. I'll follow in the path which he has marked out, and all the consequences belong to God. They're not my worry. If I lose my head, I lose my head. That's not important. The important thing is to follow out God's plan. Now, can't you admire Daniel today for taking that stand? When so many times down through human history, men have turned to what to them appears to be a logical conclusion to the situation in which they find themselves. When I was here the last time, we looked at the experience of the leaders of the church in Jerusalem, who were deeply concerned about the fact that the Jewish leaders did not want to hear the message in regard to the abolition of the ceremonial law. They still wanted to continue sacrifices and temple worship and so forth. Now the preaching of Paul was most definitely bringing upon the Christian church the threat of terrible persecution. And the leaders of the church in Jerusalem, including James, the brother of Christ, as the half-brother of Christ, and the other leaders there, felt that they should do something to avert this crisis. So they turned to human logic, and they figured that if they persuaded Paul to get into the temple and give the appearance of respect for the ceremonial law, that they would solve this problem of threatened persecution. Now when they turned to that and Paul agreed to it, instead it brought a long-lasting disaster to the church. Now again and again through history, men have done that. They've turned to human logic instead of the God's plans. They've made themselves be their own plan makers and problem solvers, and every time it's brought disaster upon themselves and upon the church of God. Now Daniel did not deviate in the least degree from God's plan. He followed in the pathway God had marked out, and therefore he could not stumble. Even though the appearances suggested to him that by going God's way he'd do nothing else but stumble. So we now read on as he comes in before the king in verse 24 of Daniel 2. Then Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon, bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Herein Daniel gives a wonderful revelation of God's character versus Satan's character. Let's go back a moment. And when the magicians who had stood before the king proved themselves guilty of unfaithfulness to the king, of not doing what they claimed to do, then they deserved to die. They deserved to die. And the king condemned them to death. They were guilty and deserving. But now Satan reached out to gather in the innocent, namely Daniel and his three friends, to destroy them with the guilty. So what's Satan's way? To destroy the innocent with the guilty. That's Satan's way. But when Daniel came to Arioch, he said, don't destroy the wise men, even though they'd be guilty. So what is God's way? God's way is to try, if possible, to save even the guilty with the innocent. Which, of course, is quite the opposite. And thanks to the presence of God through Daniel, he was successful, and the wise men did not lose their heads that day. Now we come on to verse 25. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste, and said thus unto him, I have found the man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. Now he was a really good Babylonian, wasn't he? I've done this, right? And there's no truth in this thing whatsoever. Because Arioch was going to cut Daniel's head off with all the rest of them. It was Daniel who said to Arioch, let me talk to the king. So Arioch had done no finding at all. And furthermore, Arioch misinterpreted the character of Daniel, and he said, this man will make known the interpretation. Whereas the real fact is that God was the one who would make known the interpretation. Now we come to verse 26. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the interpretation which I have seen? Unto me the dream which I have seen, the interpretation thereof. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king hath demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king? Now this is a rather unfortunate grammatical construction. It's better understood if we read it this wise. He says, the secret which the king hath demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, cannot show unto the king. In other words, they can't do it beyond their power. Now Daniel did not then say, but I can show you. No, sir. He says, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets, and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. Think of the courage and confidence exhibited by Daniel at this moment. He and his three friends represent the only recorded membership of the Church of God at that particular point of time. Now let me emphasize again that there were other faithful people, no doubt, captive in Babylon just then, but so far as the record in the book of Daniel shows, who made up the entire membership? Those four men. Now then, the temple of God in Jerusalem was laid waste. The city was burned to the ground for the most part. God's folk were held captive in the land of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar ruled the entire world. He sat there upon his golden throne in all his glittering adornments and so forth, attended by powerful guards. And there was Daniel standing in his presence, pardon me, without any kind of weaponry, any kind of backing, so far as earthly backing is concerned. And from the physical point of view, it looked as if the cause of God in the world had virtually disappeared. And the cause of Satan had all but swamped the world of that time. Now, without question, The success lay on the side of Satan's principles, not on God's principles. And from the human point of view, what would the natural expectation be? That very soon these four young men would disappear from the face of the earth, and who then would God have as a faithful witness to contend against the powers of darkness? Nobody. In that hour, when every appearance around Daniel said that God was far away and his cause is far, he said with a clear and ringing voice, there is a God in heaven. That was faith, wasn't it? That was vision. And there was confidence that even though right then things looked bad, that in the ultimate God's ways would emerge triumphant, and the ways of Babylon would lead to self-destruction, as they certainly will. Now Daniel certainly, of course, could have taken credit to himself and said, well, I can do it. But no, he would not for one moment lose sight of the fact that God was the source and he was the receiver. Page 1170, volume 4 of the Bible commentary reads as follows. In Daniel's life, the desire to glorify God was the most powerful of all motives. He realized that when standing in the presence of men of influence, a failure to acknowledge God as the source of his wisdom would have made him an unfaithful steward. And his constant recognition of the God of heaven before kings, princes, and statesmen detracted not one iota from his influence. Now the key point in that statement is this, that Daniel always recognized God as the source of his wisdom. And right there in the presence of King Nebuchadnezzar, he plainly said, God is the revealer of secrets, and he makes known to Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Next verse goes on to say, as for thee, O king, thy thoughts came up into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter? And he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. I appreciate these two verses because Daniel reveals the coverage of the prophecy. He says, first of all, that you will know what shall be in the latter days, and the latter days, of course, are at the end of time. But he also says, what shall come to pass here, which means now, and after, which is that period of time after now, right down until the latter days. King Nebuchadnezzar sat there, proud and confident that Babylon would never pass away. He was sure that the methods which he had used to build that kingdom were the only perfect methods to be used. He could look out upon the so-called Church of God and see it an utter failure, a total heap of ruins, because apostate Israel had come to that particular place. And so in his mind he could say, well now, look at what God's methods did to Israel. Look at where they are today, but look at where my methods have put me. And of course, what he would fail to see was, what he did fail to see was, there was not God's ways which put Israel where they were, but whose ways had put Israel where they were? Their own ways. It was only because Israel turned away from God's ways to their own ways that they were where they were. And if Nebuchadnezzar could have rightfully read the history of the past, he would have seen in the fate of Israel the fate of Babylon. Because man's ways will always bring about the same outworking. Now God in his great mercy, through Daniel, his faithful servant, was about to reveal to Nebuchadnezzar that exactly what happened to Israel was in turn going to happen to his kingdom. For the very simple reason that both in Israel and in Babylon, the same ways had been established, had brought about apparent initial success, but had doomed those organizations to certain ultimate failure and disaster. Now the tragedy is that the history revealed in the unfolding of the image has never been rightfully read by mankind. And only those of us who understand God's principles can rightfully read the history outlined in the image of Daniel 2. Verse 13, but as for me, the secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living. But for their sakes it shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. Let's emphasize this last statement on Daniel's part. The other part, of course, is concerning the Church of God, to whom we logically expect that provision is given. But the last part says, and that thou, O king, Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler of the world, might just know. And that word know in this connection means understand or correctly evaluate the thoughts of your heart. In other words, Daniel said, if you, God has given you this revelation so that you'll gain a new grasp of the true significance of what you're thinking, and that you'll see the existence of Babylon in a new light altogether. Now let's read on. Verse 31, we now have the familiar part of the prophecy, of course. Thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible, or wonderful, as some translations put it. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and arms of silver, his belly and thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon the feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer thrashing floors, and the wind carried them away, but no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Do you have Christology lessons? Yes. Okay. Now, on the board I'll draw a very rough picture of the image. I don't profess to be a great artist at the moment, so you have to put up with this rather crude representation. Now, this image, of course, had these various parts with descending value from the gold of the head down to the silver of the breast and arms, the brass of the belly and thighs, the iron of the legs, and the mixture of iron and clay down in the feet. Now, we'll just quickly make some points. We understand, of course, that the first one, the gold, symbolizes Babylon, which reigned from 606 to 538 BC. Then we come to Medo-Persia from 538 to 331 BC, when they were defeated at the Battle of Arbela. Greece down to 168 BC. And then we have pagan and papal Rome, which stretched down, of course, till 1798. I'd like you to observe a few points about it you probably haven't thought about before. First of all, we have a single head which symbolizes a single kingdom, but the Medo-Persian power was a double kingdom. There was the Median and the Persian arms. And so we have two arms that symbolize those two divisions in that power. Greece was a single empire, bearing in mind, of course, that the partition of that nation is not revealed in Daniel chapter 2. There's the four divisions that came after Alexander, led by his four generals, Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. But now, if the two arms symbolize two kingdoms, what must the two legs likewise symbolize? The two parts of the Roman Empire, the pagan first and the papal part thereafter. And we come down to the feet of iron and clay, and you've been taught, no doubt, in Adventist theology that symbolizes the weak and strong political powers of Europe. And the ten toes symbolize the ten kingdoms, some people pointing to the common market nations of Europe as being the fulfillment of those ten toes in the image. I'd like to correct some of these misconceptions this morning. First of all, I'll read a statement from volume 4 of the Bible Commentary in regard to the iron and the clay. Page 1168 again, volume 4, page 1168. We have come to the time when God's sacred work is represented by the feet of the image in which the iron was mixed with the miry clay. God has a chosen people, a chosen people, whose discernment must be sanctified, who must not become unholy by laying upon the foundation wood, hay, and stubble. Every soul who is loyal to the commandments of God will see that a distinguishing feature of our faith is the seventh-day Sabbath. If the government would honour the Sabbath as God has commanded, it would stand in the strength of God and in defence of the faith once delivered to the saints. The statesmen will uphold the spurious Sabbath and will mingle their religious faith with the observance of this child of the papacy. placing it above the Sabbath, which the Lord has sanctified and blessed, setting it apart for man to keep holy, as a sign between him and his people to 1,000 generations. And now comes a statement in regard to the iron and the clay. The mingling of church craft, that means church power, and statecraft is represented by the iron and the clay. This union is weakening all the power of the churches. This investing in the church with the power of the state will bring evil results. Men have almost passed the point of God's forbearance. They have invested their strength in politics and have united with the papacy. But the time will come when God will punish those who have made void his law, and their evil work will recoil upon themselves. The iron and the clay represent, according to the statement, not the weak and strong political powers of Europe, but the mingling of churchcraft and statecraft. In other words, the iron represents either church power or state power, and the clay represents whatever the iron doesn't represent. In the old interpretation, the standard interpretation, not supported by the spirit of prophecy or the Bible, just by simply by assumption, clay symbolized political power and iron symbolized political power, so that the teaching was, and still is, that the iron and the clay represents weak political powers and strong political powers. Now, which of those two symbolizes the churchcraft? Let's turn back to Jeremiah chapter 18 to learn from the scriptures what the Bible uses clay to symbolize. And this, of course, is the well-known experience of Jeremiah being sent down to the potter's house. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord saying, I begin with verse 1, Jeremiah 18 verse 1 down to verse 6. Arise and go down to the potter's house, and there I will cause thee to hear my words. Then I went down to the potter's house, and behold, he wrought a work on the wheels. And the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter, so made it again another vessel that seemed good to the potter to make it. Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, O house of Israel, cannot I do with you as this potter, saith the Lord? Behold, as the clay is in the potter's house, so are you in mine hand, O house of Israel.
Potter's hand.
No, mine hand.
No, as the clay in the potter's hand.
Yeah, right. So you're in mine hand, O house of Israel. Thank you. Now, what was the house of Israel, a political power or a religious power in God's sight? Was it the church of God or was it a nation? Church, right? Now, if you think about it for a moment, you couldn't find a more fitting symbol of the church of God than individuals in the church of God than clay. Now, we begin with a lump of wet clay. It is shapeless and it is useless in that form. Does the clay have power to form itself into a vessel of usefulness? No, it doesn't. There must be another power, namely the potter, who forms that vessel into a useful shape. What did I say?
Vessel.
Must be getting tired. Thank you very much. It forms the clay into a useful vessel. I was really thinking ahead of myself a little bit. That's why I was off the track there. Now, once the vessel has been formed, it still is not a source of supply. It must be filled from above. And so the oil, or the water, or the wine, as the case may be, all of which, of course, are symbols of gospel blessings, are poured into that vessel from above. So likewise, can any church upon this earth be itself the source of those blessings, or must it receive from above? And the answer is obvious. Now, if the church, or the individuals in the church, choose to receive those blessings and cling to them without imparting them, then what happens to the contents of that vessel? It goes bad. It stinks in due time. And that which was designed to be a blessing becomes a poison, because fermented wine, rancid oil, and those things are changed from being a blessing to being a poison. And so the vessel must receive and give and receive and give. Now, to give, what must it do? It must bow. You've got to bend the vessel over, which is the movement of bowing, and that, of course, is the symbol of service. Pride is standing up straight and stiff while others bow to you, but service, of course, is bowing down to serve others. When we wash each other's feet in the Lord's Supper, for instance, we have to bow down to do it, don't we? And so the vessel pours out its contents, to come back to the source to receive again the poor, to receive the poor, and so on. And as we're told in the book Desire of Ages, that we must, in the story of the feeding of the 5,000, the apostles came to Christ, received the bread from him, and in turn they imparted this to the multitude. In like manner, we are to do the same thing day by day in relationship to our Saviour, and those who refuse to impart will perish. Let me read your statement now from page 370 in the book Desire of Ages in this connection. Page 370 is correct. It says the disciples were the channel of communication between Christ and the people. This should be a great encouragement to his disciples today. Christ is the great center, the source of all strength. His disciples are to receive their supplies from him. The most intelligent, the most spiritually minded can bestow only as they receive. Of themselves, they can supply nothing for the needs of the soul. We can impart only that which we receive from Christ, and we can receive only as we impart to others. As we continue imparting, we continue to receive, and the more we impart, the more we shall receive. Thus we may be constantly believing, trusting, receiving, and imparting. So therefore, clay is a perfectly fitting symbol to illustrate the Church of God. Therefore, churchcraft is symbolized by the clay in the feet of the image. Now, in the image, however, the clay in the feet is miry clay. And what kind of clay is that, clean or dirty? Dirty. Now, we're familiar with the fact, of course, that a pure woman symbolizes a pure church, but a harlot woman symbolizes what kind of church? An impure church. So therefore, while pure clay symbolizes a pure church, what must miry clay symbolize? Why, an impure church. So then in these last days, the final effort upon the part of man to build a satisfactory world empire, which has not been successfully done heretofore on a lasting basis, is this mingling of iron and clay. And as much as the clay, of course, is the church craft, then the iron symbolizes the state craft. Now, those two things don't really mix. They break up after a given time when pressure is placed upon them. And so it'll prove to be, of course, when the last great pressures are placed upon that system in the closing up of this world's history. Now, a few thoughts on the 10 toes of the image. The image of Daniel 2 does not reveal two things. It does not reveal the four divisions of the Grecian Empire. There's nothing about that chapter which reveals that. Daniel 7 and Daniel 8 do, and Daniel 11 also does, but not Daniel 2. And likewise, Daniel 2 does not reveal the final ten kingdoms into which the Roman Empire broke up. Now let's go back to the 10 divisions into which the Roman Empire broke up. As you remember from your history books, and I'm sure you're all good at dates and history, that in the year 476 AD, the incursions of the barbarian hordes began and was completed by the year 533 AD. Now in that period, the 10 kingdoms were formed. The Vandals, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, the Heruli, and so on. You know them all, so I won't repeat them today. Now, the prophecy of Daniel 7 calls for the plucking up of three of those horns by the roots. So by 538 AD, those three horns had been plucked up by the roots. First of all, Belisarius went to Justinian's command in North Africa, and he literally wiped out the Vandals, and they vanished from the face of the earth. Remember that in Daniel 7 it says the horns are plucked up by the roots. If any of you folk have been farmers, you know that when you take a cow's horn out by the roots, does it ever grow again? It never does. Take a tree out by the roots, does it ever grow again? No. So taking those horns or kingdoms out by the roots paints the picture of a kingdom being obliterated, never ever to grow again. It was finished. Now then, that left only seven of the original 10 kingdoms into which the Roman Empire broke up. Now if we say that the 10 toes down here represent the same 10 kingdoms as were back there in the period between 476 and 533 AD, then where do we get, how can we have those three horns being resurrected again? We can't do that. It's just not possible. The 10 toes are the same 10 kings as you find in Revelation chapter 17. There are 10 final horns and the final beast. And a very important rule must be observed in the interpretation or finding of those ten great powers. Now, first of all, are those ten powers made of iron and clay with the rest of the feet? They are. They're also iron and clay, because the feet and the toes are together made of iron and clay. Now, the final beast of Revelation chapter 17 occupies how much of the world as a dominating power? Only Europe or the entire world? Right, the entire world. Now, when we have a beast, and this is a rule in Bible prophecy in Daniel Revelation, when we have a beast that occupies what is the then known world of that time. Now, obviously, of course, Nebuchadnezzar's father, we know, did not rule over North America or South America or Australia. He didn't go too far east into Asia either at that time. But the Bible plainly says that he was a world empire, a world ruler, that the whole world was under his power. Well, obviously, of course, the whole world then did not extend as far as it does today, so far as habitation is concerned. But when we come down to pagan Rome and that beast has ten horns, then to whatever extent that power ruled, the ten horns occupied the same territory. So when in the last days this final beast of Revelation 7 occupies the entire world, and the ten horns on that beast must also be occupants of the entire world, not just simply a part of it. And the entire world in these last days, of course, is truly global in the most complete sense of that term. So let's get away from those old limited and erroneous concepts in regard to the feet and the toes. The iron clay does not represent weak and strong nations of Europe. The iron clay represents churchcraft and statecraft, and the ten toes in the image symbolize, not if they do symbolize kingdoms at all, because we don't find the ten fingers up here being called ten kingdoms, do we? So I really question as to whether those ten toes are taken that way. But if they do, they do symbolize the ten powers which in the last days, according to Revelation 17, will occupy the entire world collectively as supporters of the papal power. And those ten kings, of course, will be more religious than political, because they have no kingdom as yet, and receive power as kings only 1 hour with the beast. And Sister White specifically says that they are great religious powers, including apostate Protestantism and the other nine religious divisions of the world. But we're not studying Revelation 17 right now, so I won't go into that too deeply. Now, I felt it important to get our minds clarified as to what each part of the image represented before we look at what the image as a whole is designed to teach us in regard to the unfolding of the scroll. The next point is to make that there are two mountains in Daniel 2. There's the mountain from which the stone is cut, and the mountain into which the stone grows. I'll illustrate it as follows, and we'll turn to Daniel 2 to identify the presence of these two mountains. Here's the first one over here, and from this the stone is cut out and descends upon the image and shatters it to pieces, and then that stone goes into a great mountain which fills the entire world. So there are two mountains. Let's read about them in the second chapter of the book of Daniel. Now, first of all, in verse 34 it says, "Thou sawest till that the stone was cut out without hands." Now, that verse doesn't tell you where it's cut from, but in verse 45 it does. It says in verse 45, "Forasmuch as thou sawest that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands." That's the first mountain, the one from which the stone is cut. The other mountain we read in verse 35. "Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer thrashing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." In other words, the stone didn't go back to the original mountain and reoccupy the place there, but became a fresh mountain which in turn filled the whole world. So then, there are two mountains, the one from which the stone was cut and the one to which the stone eventually grew. What does a mountain symbolize? The answer is found in verse 44, where it says, "And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms shall stand forever." Now, Daniel makes the statement, and then he refers in verse 45 to the symbol which bespeaks this fact. Verse 45 says, "Forasmuch as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and it had broken pieces of the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof is sure." If you put those two verses together, you'll have no trouble recognizing the fact that a mountain in Bible prophecy is symbolic of a kingdom. And back in Jeremiah chapter 55 verse 25, we find that Babylon is described there also as being a mountain. Jeremiah 51 verse 25. "Behold, I am against thee, O destroying mountain, saith the Lord, which destroyest all the earth, and I will stretch out mine hand upon thee, and roll thee down from the rocks, and will make thee a burnt mountain." So here the kingdom of Babylon is called a destroying mountain, whereas of course the kingdom of God is described as being a constructive one, not a destructive one, in Daniel the second chapter. Now there in essence is the message which God conveyed to Nebuchadnezzar to the prophet Daniel. And in that, God designed Nebuchadnezzar to see, as he did come to see, as we'll read later in a later study at the end of the chapter, the king did come to see the message which God was conveying to him. And that message was, it is possible by human works to build a kingdom, but not a permanent one, only a temporary one. Like drug medication, which appears to give a solution to the problem, but which in reality only changes the nature and location of the disease, so human efforts of world kingdom building appear to solve the problem, but a little later the disease springs up in a new geographical location, in a new form of government. Right? And so it continues. Now men never learn. Men build Babylon by human works, and the very hour of its apparent greatest glory, it simply fell apart. And then what did men do? By the same procedures that brought about the destruction of this first power, they built another kingdom. Now, because the procedures were the same, what must the outcome be? Likewise the same. And so Greece tried to do by the same methods what those methods had failed to produce in the past. So pagan Rome and then papal Rome, and finally men will try again by the same methods to put the whole thing together in the churchcraft and statecraft coalition in these last days of human history. But the foundations of the image of iron and clay, which don't have the power to support that system, and will crumble to dust and pass away to give place to a kingdom built upon altogether different principles, which will last forever and forever. And the whole appeal of Daniel chapter 2 is to recognize the outworking of these principles, human principles, versus divine principles, to make our choice as to what is going to be the way of life that we will follow.
Okay. Good.